Welcome to the Ephesiology Podcast in our series, Archaeology Meets Missiology, the Mission of God in the Records of Time. Today we have Michael, our resident ephesiologist, and I'm Andrew Johnson in Houston, Texas. And we are thrilled to be joined by Dr. Clint Arnold. Now, he was the former dean at Talbot for 10 years, 12 through 22. He is the past president of ETS. He serves on the Translation Oversight Committee for the ESV. And he is the editor of the four-volume, here, just get ready for it, Zondervan Illustrated Bible Backgrounds Commentary, for which he wrote commentaries on Acts, Ephesians, and Colossians. Dr. Arnold, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, great. Thank you for the privilege of being part of this broadcast.
This is fun.
Yeah, well, it's our privilege, really. It's our honor, Clint, that you're here. I came across, well, I've known about Clint Arnold for forever, being a profound scholar on the letter to the church in Colossae, and but just recently reached out to him after a visit to the ancient site of Colossae, and we had a nice conversation about what's happening there, or literally what's not happening there, and was excited that he was completing his commentary, which he has done, on Colossians in the Zondervan exegetical series.
Right, the next awesome long title.
Yeah, which I've been working through. A formidable commentary, to say the least, but grateful for that, and just love how you are engaging with the context of Asia Minor and the archaeology in Asia Minor, and seeing how that's bringing light to the letter to the church in Colossae. So thanks, Clint, for coming on and talking about this.
Yeah, it's a delight to talk about Colossians. It's been a big part of my life for many, many years, and it seems like I can never get enough of it. I just enjoy going 10 miles deep, but not in a academic-y sort of way, but I look at it as looking at the real life context and finding evidences and inscriptions and archaeology that help us to see what life was like among real people living at that time.
That's cool.
That is cool. Okay, so let's talk to the real person that is Clint Arnold. What are some things? What are some things that we could that you would be willing to share on a public podcast about yourself that others might know about you? What is Clint like on the West Coast?
Well, I have a background in agriculture.
Yeah.
I grew up with ranching, and I grew up with farming. My mother was a rodeo star, and competed in rodeos in California and Nevada. I know an awful lot about growing cotton and growing alfalfa, those sorts of things. So that's a side of me that a lot of people actually don't know. But I've been teaching here at Talbot School of Theology, which is part of Biola University in Southern California. I've been teaching here. I'm embarrassed to say how long it's been. It's been 38 years. I came in 1987, and I loved our students that we continue to draw. It's been a great community of faculty members, and it's been just a great home for a long time.
Wow. Okay, so just again, personally, because you've scratched that, does your love of agriculture, like, does it drive you out into a garden? Like, are you the one who's tending things around your house to make it look beautiful? Are you trying to not just make it look beautiful? Are you trying to grow things that you can eat? Or like, how does this manifest today for you?
Well, actually, I wish we could grow cotton in our backyard, but we can't.
That's not the climate.
Nor alfalfa. So those skills are probably not as useful. But we have a good size backyard, and we have planted a lot of trees, so we've got a whole assortment of trees that are fruit-bearing trees.
That's what I was hoping you were going to say.
Including Asian pears, longans, various kinds of apples, plums, all kinds of citrus. Love just walking out my office door here and grabbing a tangerine or a navel orange and chewing on it. And no, so there is a little bit of that. So,
That's neat.
Well,
All
I'm
right,
envious.
Clint. Yeah. Okay. It's time to get to the geeky
Yeah.
academic stuff because
Yeah.
I'm super excited
So, yeah, good.
about this. Your background has focused on Colossians since your dissertation. So walk us through this because this recent commentary isn't the only thing that you've written on Colossians. I've loved your book, The Colossian Syncretism. Which, if I remember correctly, that was basically your dissertation written in a book form.
Yeah, it's actually a little bit more complex than that. I went to Aberdeen University in the northeast of Scotland that felt like it was 2 miles off the Arctic Circle for a guy that grew up in Bakersfield. Went there in 1983 and went with the express purpose of seeing if I could find a topic that would be academically justifiable that had to do with the power of God in the life of the believer. In other words, how do we experience God's power for transformation and growth? And as I got into it, I realized through statistical analysis and everything that there's more power-denoting terminology in Colossians and Ephesians than in any of the others of Paul's letters. And so my professor said, let's focus on that, focus on Colossians and Ephesians, and rigorously put the question, why? Why is there such an emphasis on power in these two letters? Well, it didn't take long to realize that one of the reasons for that is there is a strong emphasis on the opposing sphere of power, principalities, powers, authorities, spiritual warfare in Ephesians 6, and so on. And so that led me into trying to better understand the first century cultural context. What was driving all of this interest in spiritual power? What was driving the Ephesians to practice magic? Because you'll remember in Acts 19, the burning of the magical texts that you know very well. And what was that all about? What was that like? And so on. That took me into papyri, inscriptions, archaeological evidences, all of which gave greater insight into just the world of the people who were becoming Christians. And the practice of magic, as it was in Ephesus, was something that involved the trafficking of spirits. And so it wasn't a surprise to find out that Paul would address those issues when he wrote to these new converts in Colossians and Ephesians. So my initial work that became my dissertation in Aberdeen was focused on Ephesians and Colossians. And so my examiners graciously encouraged me to publish the work after it was approved. And I submitted it to a publisher, and they said, yeah, we would like to publish it, but you need to reduce it by 40%.
Oh my
Oh my
goodness.
gosh, that takes my heart out. And so, but it was on Ephesians and Colossians. And so I thought, well, what if I just cut everything on Colossians and just do, a monograph, an academic monograph on Ephesians. So I did that, streamlined that one, and that became a book called Ephesians Power and Magic. And
That's right.
it was published by Cambridge University Press and had a very good reception for illuminating the world of the New Testament, in particularly Ephesus. Then in 1991, I took a sabbatical year and went to Germany, in Tübingen, Germany. And I thought there's a lot more here with Colossians that I could look into. They had a marvelous archaeological library there. And so I spent a year researching the background of Colossians, and that became the book called The Colossian Syncretism. So Long story short.
Yeah, good. No, that's
a great story.
Yeah, it is. Because it raises this question, which I think has been a part of your desire, if not passion, for the excavation of Colossae. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that. I remember in a conversation that we had that you had mentioned, if I remember correctly, that you've been waiting since 1986 mm-hmm. for that site to be excavated.
Yeah, my first trip to Colossae was just a year earlier than that, actually, 1985. That's getting to be a long time ago.
We don't need to talk about old things. It's fine.
And at that time, there was no roads to the ancient site of Colossae. You had to beat around on dirt roads, and it was very difficult to find. And all there was this mound of dirt out there. But the site of Colossae had been identified. You could walk around it, and the difficulty in walking around it, especially for a guy that grew up on a farm, is you see all this building material protruding out of the mound, and you want to stick a shovel in it and start uncovering it and seeing what's there, but don't want to do that and violate the law. So there have been a number of groups that have tried and petitioned the Turkish government for permission to excavate Colossae, going way back into the 70s and so on. Nothing has ever stuck until recently, and that is there is a really robust archaeological program not too far away from Colossae at the city of Denizli called Pamukkale mm-hmm. University, and they have now made a proposal to the Turkish government to begin excavation at Colossae. And I'm happy to be able to say that at the end of December, the Turkish government gave their final approval for the excavation of Colossae. So a man named Barış Yener, a professor at Pamukkale University, an archaeologist, will be the chief excavator. They're in the process of raising funds now to build their excavation house and to purchase equipment. He anticipates putting a shovel into the ground in June this year. So wow. It's an amazing, amazing time. It's just laid there unexcavated for hundreds of years, and we finally get to witness it. And I'm happy it happened. It's going to happen before I die.
And so your plane ticket is booked for the end of May, so that you can just stand next to that shovel when it goes in, right?
Well, actually, yeah, that's not a joke. We're I'm leading a tour there May 18th through early June.
Wow,
It'll go through Greece and Turkey.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. Well, that's exciting. Well, tell us then. I mean, so the site has not been excavated for centuries, mm-hmm. But you're writing about Colossians and the syncretism that you see there. How much does a biblical scholar rely upon the excavations of these ancient sites that correspond to the letters that we have in the New Testament? How much do you rely upon that? And then in the case of Colossians, since that site hasn't been excavated, where do you go to find the information that helps to inform the interpretation of the letter?
Right. Yeah. In this commentary that I've written recently, I rely on a lot of inscriptional data, archaeological data, and so on. But the site hasn't been excavated, so where have I been pulling it from? We've been blessed. I could say that there have been a number of adjacent sites that have been excavated. And so in the last 20 years, a site that has received just vigorous and extensive excavation work is Laodicea, which is only 8 miles away. Laodicea, the archaeologist there has been very aggressive in excavating the site, restoring what they uncover. And it's interesting to note that in Turkish excavations like this, for every dollar they spend excavating, they spend $10 in restoration. So they do a marvelous job of preserving and restoring and this. So a lot has been discovered in Laodicea. 11 miles away is Hierapolis. It's mentioned in Colossians 4. extensive excavation work there over the years, lots of inscriptions, lots of statues, buildings, things of this nature discovered, and in a variety of other locations. So comparatively, we can look at some of this data and correlate it and ask, you know, where it might inform our understanding of Colossians. But there have been some elements that are directly tied to Colossians, and that would be in the realm of ancient coins, the numismatics, where we know what, for instance, what gods and goddesses were worshipped in Colossae because of the coins discovered that depict certain deities on them.
Wow. Wow. And so when you're looking at these inscriptions from Laodicea, Hierapolis, and we know, as you mentioned, that both of those cities are written about in the letter to the church in Colossae. In fact, it's true, isn't it, that Colossians is intended as much for Laodicea and Hierapolis as it is for Colossae itself. You're seeing then the culture of that area that's in the Lycus Valley. I mean, these cities, as you mentioned, are close together, that there's a similarity in those cultures.
Yeah, precisely. So I would expect, and the coins bear this out, that a lot of the same deities that were worshipped in Hierapolis, Laodicea, would be worshipped at Colossae. So when they discover temples at Colossae, there's probably comparable temples elsewhere and so on. But Colossae may have had distinctive alliances with a certain deity, a patron deity, like you would know with Ephesus and Artemis. We will find out what the commitments were to pagan deities and so on. We'll also hopefully find out, it would be great if they could find a synagogue so that we could have a little bit better understanding of Judaism in that city. And there's just a lot of things they could potentially find that would help illuminate a great deal for us.
Yeah. What do you feel then are some of those? Okay, so you've mentioned already the synagogue or the Jewish synagogue. What are some of the things that you hope that they find that will help you even get more excited about what you have already believed about things in Colossae?
Right. Yeah, that's excellent. Colossae has a very specific and very strange problem going on there. It's often referred to as the Colossian heresy. There is some kind of teaching that is emerging in the church that Epaphras, the founder of the church, and the Apostle Paul view as dangerous to the health and stability of the church. And so there's these warnings in the letter. But then there's these little snippets of description about it. There's things like worship of angels, visionary experience, observing various kinds of festivals, mutilation of the body, and various descriptors like this. And is there going to be in the excavation work at Colossae, will we find evidences of local worship that help us better understand the unique contours of this strange teaching that's emerging, that's influenced the church? The guy that's teaching it, I think, is a Christian, but he's carrying that stuff over with him into his Christian life. And that's what we would call syncretism, the combining of his Christianity with his previous beliefs. And so I could imagine that there would be a number of things that would help us better understand what this was all about through the discovery here.
And but regionally speaking, you've seen some of this already, right? That's giving you some sort of clues. I recall in your commentary, you spent some time talking about Miletus, and the worship, the potential worship of angels in that context.
Yeah, and there's been some stuff even much more closely tied to Colossae that can help us with that. So one of the big enigmas in Colossians was this, is this idea of worshiping angels. What is that all about? Are we supposed to envision, hey, a group of people on Sunday night saying, hey, come on, let's go over and meet at my house and I'll get the guitar and we'll sing some songs to angels. What is this worshiping angels? It's a unique word for worship. It's not the typical word for worship. And the word in Colossians 2:18 could refer and probably does refer to rituals involving angels. And one of the things I've discovered from around Colossae is there have been lots of inscriptions discovered that mention angels, either the word angelos itself or the names of angels. And all of them are very similar. All of them have to do with invoking or calling upon angels for help, calling upon angels for protection, calling upon angels for healing, in this sort of thing. A few years ago, one of these was discovered in a tomb in Hierapolis. It was a piece of silver, actually, that was inscribed and rolled up and placed in a tube that was in a tomb. And it was an invocation of angels. It calls on, I think, Michael and Gabriel and Uriel and so on, protect me. And basically the idea is I'm under some kind of spiritual attack. Would you please protect me, you angels? The difficulty is that we have pagan deities mentioned right alongside Jewish angels. And so we don't even know if this belonged to a Christian, if it belonged to a Jew, or if it belonged to a pagan. And by pagan, I mean a Gentile, non-Jew, non-Christian. Because for people involved with magic like this, it wasn't an issue of orthodoxy. It was more of an issue of what's powerful, what works, what will really help protect me, and that kind of thing.
It's very much what I think Paul Hebert describes as a mechanistic worldview, a cause and effect. You know, here's a cause. What is the effect? Or here's an effect. What is the cause of this? And so, that certainly is fascinating to think about.
It also doesn't sound super ancient in a way, only because had I taken out of your mouth, Clint, the names of angels and put in the names of saints that some people pray to have that effect, right? Like you're talking about, Michael, that I need to have safe travels. So I will pray to the saint of and then get my safe travels. It doesn't feel too different from the way that certain people try to live out their faith now. And it might even gain that question of, I can't even tell if this person is a Christian, if they're Jewish, or if they're pagan. Anyway, these are things rolling around in my mind to connect some of what was ancient and make it seem far more current.
And I would expect that the excavation at Colossae will turn up a lot of stuff like this. I would think that they will find more magical texts that are written on lead. These were typically cursed tablets where, you tick off your neighbor in some way and he consults a shaman figure and it fixes a curse upon you or your livestock or your family or something. Then these are rolled up, deposited in tombs and wells and things like that. And these things are popping up all over the ancient world and give us an insight into these practical day-to-day life kinds of matters in this animistic kind of context. I think we'll find a lot more like that. I think we'll find amulets. I mean, various kinds of amulets. But beyond that, we'll find in Colossae lots of inscriptions that are very typical in ancient cities. They're called honorific inscriptions, where people are honored for civic works that they have. And one of the values of any of these kinds of inscriptions, we often talk about the Koine Greek, the Koine language of Greek, which was written for the common people. And inscriptions are conveyors of the Koine language. They're meant to be read by those that were literate. They're not highfalutin philosophical treatises or anything like that. They are just the common everyday language, and that's the language that the New Testament was written in. So there's just a lot of different things that could contribute to our better understanding of the New Testament in this world.
Wow. Wow. Well, that's exciting. Now, there have been some preliminary, we don't call them excavations, but explorations, I suppose, of Colossae. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that, because they're using ground-penetrating radar to kind of map out some of the sites.
Mm-hmm. So over the last 2 to 3 years, as we've been waiting for the final approvals to come through, there has been site surveys undertaken by the guy named as the chief archaeologist, Baris Yainer. He and a team of people have done ground-penetrating radar of the Colossian Mound. It's a 200-foot-high, just looks like a hill with its top cut off, where the focal point of the ancient city was located, just covered up with dirt over those years. And the ground-penetrating radar is able to see outlines of major structures. And so what it has done is it has helped Professor Yainer identify where some of the most promising places to begin excavation would be. And so he's identified those places, and that's presumably where they will begin. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, they have, over the land around Colossae and on Colossae, have tried to find bits and pieces of pottery that has been just remnants of broken vessels and things. And there has been some significant discovery as a result of that, because they're able to look at the pottery and decide, you know, what age it was in. Was it Byzantine? Was it Roman? Was it Hellenistic? And they found some from all of those eras. But the surprising thing is that they have found some from the late Chalcolithic era. And we're talking 3,000 years BC, so before the time of Abraham. So there's an ancient settlement at Colossae that I mean, so it's not just the first century we will learn about in the excavation. We'll learn about Colossae through the ages as it's excavated.
And is that corresponding with the time of the Hittites and so on?
Yes. Yeah. So we would expect that there would be Hittite settlement there. One Turkish archaeologist, Bahadir Duman, speculates that the name Colossae itself came from a Hittite. And this is from the age of Abraham and earlier, that it comes from a Hittite name as its origin. But
Well, the exciting days. I wish I could be with you in May. I'm going to be back. I was just there a couple of weeks ago, and we drove by the site again and walked around, and still nothing, although they do now have two security guards out there. But we'll be back in November, and hopefully there'll be some progress there. But I'd love to be with you and see your face when you see that site at the beginning of its excavation.
Well, I'd love to be with you in November when there's actually things dug up. I mean, that's a great time to be there, just to see the beginning of the excavation work.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the fun things about Colossae is that we're getting a real good picture of what a site looks like prior to its excavation, and then to be able to track with it over the next several years as it's being excavated will be very exciting. So, good. Well, Clint, obviously Colossians is a passion for you. I know that, at least in your Colossians syncretism book, one of your one of your applications is to the missions world. As you think about syncretism and ministry into different contexts where there are animistic communities, tell us a little bit about that as we're thinking about the application of Colossians today.
Yeah. One of the surprises for me after I published the book Colossians Syncretism, which is a heavy going academic book, was that it ended up being used in a few places that I didn't expect. For instance, at Fuller Theological Seminary School of World Mission, Dudley Woodbury taught a class for a number of years on ministering in a folk Islamic context and talked about the animism, syncretism, shamanism that you find in a folk Islam context, and used my Colossian syncretism as a springboard for helping the students that he had think biblically about this, now seeing that Colossians is really relevant for understanding shamanism, for folk Islam, and shamanism in a variety of contexts. And so in my understanding of what the problem was at Colossae, I characterize it as a form of shamanism. And what we mean by that is that there is, in the ancient city of Colossae, there was a person who was widely perceived to have deep understanding into the supernatural realm, deep understanding into the ways that spirits work and the ways that you can ward off curses, avoid the evil eye, construct amulets to protect yourself, bring healing, and to basically serve the community through supernatural spiritualistic ways. And that to gain that kind of knowledge, esoteric knowledge, this person needed to undergo ritual initiation into a mystery. They needed to have the visionary experience that would provide them with the wisdom and insight. And then they needed to know all of these arcane and magical texts and formulas, incantations and things that would enable them to serve the community well. And that's the kind of person that I think has become a Christian, combined their Christianity with their shamanism, and is now trying to serve the Christian community in that way. So this idea of shamanism is nothing new. I mean, it spans all animistic cultures. We have, and you know this well as a missiologist, that we have shamans in just a variety of modern cultures today. Here in Southern California, where there's a large Mexican community, if I sit with a group of Hispanics and ask if, does anyone know who the curandero is that you could go to, they would all know, and they would be able to tell you about it, but it's not something they widely talk about. A curandero is a medicine man or a healer that you go to if your house is haunted, if you're facing supernatural opposition of some time. But so many cultures have these, and I think that's what's going on at Colossae. I don't see it as a sophisticated philosophical system of speculation that they're engaging in. I think it's something grassroots, deep, and popular that is very common in the ancient Mediterranean world, and anthropologically is present in so many animistic cultures.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. That's good. So I'd love thinking missiologically about these things and excited about your work. Clint's recent commentary on Colossians is, as I mentioned at the top of the program, is a formidable commentary. I kind of chuckled at this, but I get it. I mean, I get the passion. I love the detail mm-hmm. that you're putting into this commentary, and really have come to value what you've written. But I think you even acknowledge at the beginning of the commentary that you're writing a 700-page commentary on a letter that's 1,600 Greek words or so, I think. Yeah. And I appreciated so much that you recognize that and acknowledge it at the beginning. But the detail that you go into in this commentary is just significant and substantial. So I want to be sure to encourage our listeners to go out, look for that commentary, buy that commentary. You will not regret the depth that Clint is going into to help us to understand that very important letter from the Apostle Paul.
And I think part of it is trying to help people understand the world at that time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Which is critical.
Which is really critical. And this is a dimension of the world that some commentators just don't pursue understanding very well. I think this whole notion of belief in gods and goddesses, polytheism, and spirits and principalities and powers and all of this kind of stuff is there's so much evidence for this in the ancient world that people just don't even realize is there.
Mm. Well, and I think you've done such a wonderful job of bringing all of that together for us and helping us to see how archaeology, epigraphy, all of this is so vital in our understanding of the New Testament text. So thank you for your work.
Well, I'm glad to hear that a few people appreciate it.
That's good. Okay. Well, if that number has increased and there are people who want to keep up with you beyond going out immediately and purchasing this exegetical commentary on Colossians, where can they keep up with the latest and the greatest work that you are doing?
Yeah. I might mention that if you want a thumbnail sketch of, you don't want to buy the full commentary or you want to just see what it's all about first. I've written the study notes in the ESV Study Bible on Colossians, and that would give you kind of an overview of what I do in some of the directions that I go. In terms of following me now, I don't have a big social media presence, so I'm not doing TikTok videos or anything like that. I write occasionally for a blog that we have at Talbot School of Theology called the Good Book Blog, and that's one place. But I anticipate doing a little bit more now that the excavation at Colossae is getting started. Baris Yehner has started an X or Twitter account on the Colossae excavation project, and so I'm trying to debate now on what might be an appropriate venue to say a bit more, and haven't kind of landed on a solution to that yet.
Well, go to Blue Sky. That's my opinion. Okay.
Well, I was just going to say, come back to the Ephesiology podcast. We want to hear more.
We'll just have monthly updates with Clint, right? It'll be our own segment. It'll be great.
Yeah.
Well, Clint, thank you so much, truly, for being on with us. It's so cool to hear not just what God has done, what God is doing, but there's just this hopeful nugget that's sitting with this excavation. And so we are prayerfully excited with you on what is to come and what more we can learn by what comes out. Listener, thank you for joining us. We're honored that you gave us your time and wanted to hear more about what God has done and is doing in that area of the world. If you are interested about more of the Archaeology Meets Missiology series, please go and check out some of the rest of those episodes or whatever your podcatcher tells you we have also talked about. We would love for you to explore our back catalog. Please check out masterclasses.ephesiology.com. We are passionate about theological education, and not just archaeology. So see what more we have to offer you and what God might do in and through you in this world. So for Michael, Clint, and myself, thank you for doing theology and community with us today on the Ephesiology Podcast.